My uncontrollable movements called TD, tardive dyskinesia, felt embarrassing. I felt like disconnecting. I asked my doctor about treating my TD and learned about Ingrezza, a prescription medicine clinically proven for reducing TD in adults. That's always one capsule, once daily, and number one prescribed. People taking Ingrezza can stay on most mental health meds.
Ingrezza can cause depression, suicidal thoughts, or actions in patients with Huntington's disease. Call your doctor if you become depressed, have sudden behavior or mood changes, or suicidal thoughts. Don't take Ingrezza if allergic. Serious side effects may include allergic reactions like sudden, potentially fatal swelling and hives, sleepiness, the most common side effect, and heart rhythm problems. Know how Ingrezza affects you before operating a car or dangerous machinery. Report fever, stiff muscles, or problems thinking, as these might be life-threatening. Shaking, stiffness, drooling, and trouble with moving or balance may occur.
Take control by asking your doctor about Ingrezza.
Learn more at Ingrezza.com. That's Ingrezza.com.
Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. Recognized on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland. With fast, fair finance decisions. Made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers. Looking to become a partner? Get in touch at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to this latest episode of Magnified with Matt Cooper, in which I speak to people who've had fascinating careers in entertainment or business or politics or today sport, because Conor Nyland has just written his autobiography about his time on the tennis circuit. And he didn't enjoy the heights like an Andre Agassi, who has the most storied autobiography from sport, perhaps, but Conor Nyland tells some terrific stories and provides an incredible insight into what it's like to be an aspiring professional athlete. Conor Nyland, thank you for joining me for Magnified. I had you in on The Last Word recently talking about your book, The Racket, on tour at tennis's golden generation and the other 99% of which you were part. And I was fascinated by the book, and I didn't get enough time with you on the radio, so thank you for coming in again.
Great to be here.
And the real thing I'm really interested in talking to you about, the topic I suppose that really jumped out at me, is motivation. Mm. I'm fascinated by how you were motivated to stick with it. And also we'll get to maybe the role of your parents in all of that as well, because I often wonder how much of things are self-motivated, that it has to come from within, and how much is imposed upon you by others. What was it for you?
Yeah, and I think it started as self-motivation, but it was just, I enjoyed tennis and loved playing, and I had a role model in my sister and loved whacking the ball around, and I was good at it. And then probably to the age of 9, 10, 11, it was like that. And then when I started to, start to play the big national events and start to travel internationally, it started to become practice as opposed to play, and that's when it starts to get a little bit more feeling like homework as opposed to just messing around and being good at something. And that's, I remember that was the first bit of tension, maybe, when I didn't necessarily want to practice every day or 6 days a week, even though that was what was needed. So that was when there was maybe a little bit of a push and a pull, and the first line of the book, or after the prologue, it's talking about quitting and telling my parents at sort of 10, 11, that was sort of when I wanted to take a bit of a break. And my parents sort of pushing back, going, no, they wanted the best for me, wanted me to keep playing. So that, it started at that early age. But then as a 29-year-old, I'm still out on the tour and still unbelievably motivated to try and achieve things in tennis. So I started to become, it came back to me again. It sort of went to, my motivation was sort of passed over to my parents for a little while and then sort of passed back to me after a while.
That you still went to 29, though, is remarkable, isn't it? There are few enough tennis players who are in your sort of level who continue to that age.
Yeah, I mean, I did obviously go to college in the States, and went to Berkeley and played college tennis there for 4 years. So it wasn't like I went on the tour at 15 or 16 and was still out there at 29. And that was my only life. So even though I was playing a high level of tennis in college in the States, I had a normal life between the age of 16 and 23, that maybe you don't have on the tour. And I think if I had gone pro earlier, like some guys do, I don't know if I would have stuck around at 29 and maybe at 23, 24 gone, I have had enough of this.
But how high might you have gone? I mean, you're the highest ranked Irish tennis player ever by getting to 129 in the world. But if you had gone a different route and gone to the tour and got more training earlier, how high might you have gone?
Well, this is it. I mean, we found ourselves at Politieri Tennis Academy, the greatest tennis academy in the world at 16, me and my friend Stephen Nugent, and we were training with the Williams sisters and Peter Korda, Andy Roddick. We were getting unbelievable exposure. And I felt like I was getting better nearly by the hour when I was over there in that environment. And they offered us a place at the end of the 2 weeks, and we both went back to our old safer kind of existences back in Ireland and England. And I don't know why, but we felt like maybe it was too, our parents thought it was too big a leap, too big a jump. We wanted to go the safer route. But again, yeah, I probably would have been a better tennis player and had a higher ranking, but maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe it wouldn't have worked out that cleanly.
It's a little bit vague in the book as to how serious that offer was. I mean, what sort of offer was it, in the sense of, it wasn't a sort of a scholarship. It
would have been requiring
your parents to pony up a lot of money.
And, you know, that's a very fair point. And we never quite got to that probably second conversation, but you're right. There was a there was the 2 weeks that had gone great. We had started in this this group that was miles off the first court. After one shot, they realised, oh, these guys are international junior level players. They thought we were just two lads over, I don't know, for a couple of weeks for a camp. So then after a day and a half, whatever, we were with the Williams sisters, you know, the top court. And after 2 weeks, this gentleman, you know, asked for a meeting with my parents, went over there with me and Stephen, and they called us into this canopied area beside the courts and sat down and said, listen, we love how you guys work. We'd love to have you back, you know, if it's something you'd consider. And we just sort of went off, talked amongst ourselves, and there was no sort of, yeah, well, is that a 100% scholarship? Is that a 50% scholarship? Is that, what is that? And that conversation never happened. I think they probably would have given us some sort of a scholarship if we needed it, because we were that kind of level. But yeah, we never had that second stage.
Because the other thing, that one of the many things that's fascinating in this great book, is how even when you were in your mid-20s, you were learning things as to how to improve your game, which possibly you should have learned a decade earlier.
Totally. I mean, yeah, simple stuff like, you know, nutrition and psychology, things that really helped me. I was maybe learning at 28, 29. I remember sending in my food diary for my week on tour to Karina Tobin, was the nutritionist I was working with. I think she was working with the Dublin footballers at the time as well. And I sent her in my food diary. She's like, it's great, but it's, you know, it's a bowl of cereal and two slices of toast. It's like what people who are going into an office are eating. You need to be, you know, throwing three eggs in a smoothie and all the rest on top. So simple things, but I get that information at 27, 28. And then, yeah, technical things, you know, Joe Dwyer, who I talk about, my eccentric coach, who I started working with in my mid-20s, really helped me develop a slice backhand, which I never had, a running forehand. Again, things that, you know, I should have probably had in my arsenal at 17 or 18 if I was playing full-time and getting the best coaching. So I was kind of piecing all this together, and that's why my highest ranking was at the age of 29. And, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. You know, you should really be peaking at 24, 25, and then you hang on at that level and hopefully have 6 or 7 years there, whereas I only had one or two.
So there's so many things that I want to ask you about. I mean, tennis, for those people who have played tennis, I mean, when most of us, like myself, is our hack around a court, we're lucky if we can keep a rally going. We're lucky if we can get a serve in. You, on the other hand, are playing at such a level. But what's the difference when you're in the 100s in the world with the elite players we might watch on television? Are they more powerful in their serve? Do they hit harder shots? Are they more consistently getting the ball to the baseline, putting pressure on the returner? What are the things that make the elite players different?
Yeah, it's yes, yes, and yes to all those. The very, very top guys have the absolute full package. You know, you don't realize how big these guys are until you're standing beside them, like Murray, Djokovic, Nadal. They're all 6'2", 6'3". But they move like guys who are, you know, 5'8" or 5'9". They cover the ground so well, it's really hard to get the ball past them. When I trained with Andy Murray in London a couple of times, I felt like I was thinking, how am I going to accumulate points here? You know, what can I do? He's serving at 135 miles an hour. he doesn't miss a return. And when he does, it's on your toes. Like when I was playing Djokovic at the US Open, I was still almost in my service motion when the ball was at my feet. Like I was coming out of my service motion. I was still a little bit crouched and was coming up.
And he'd returned
to get
ready
to get ready for it, and the ball was already down my throat. And it's a subtle enough difference in terms of the depth that they hit the ball. Like to make it to the top 100 or 150 in the world, you need to be very consistent. So you know, all the players, they don't really miss, but the Djokovic's and the Murray's and the Nadal's, they are able to hit the ball literally between 2 and 3 feet from the baseline consistently over and over again, no matter where they are on the court. And then they obviously have their weapons as well. So it's probably a simple answer, but they have just the full package. Plus, you know, when it gets really tight and gets really tough, they seem to be the guys who never choke. They never dip. They don't get angry. Okay, there's occasionally some outbursts, but they seem to be able to max that out as well.
You're very honest in the book about the times that essentially you did choke.
Mm.
Again, how much might that have stopped you realizing your full physical potential?
Yeah, I mean, I think the obviously the match against Manarino at Wimbledon, I was up 4-1 double break.
This is in the first round. You've made it past the qualifying round and you're in Wimbledon.
I'm in Wimbledon.
To play Roger Federer in the next round.
The winner plays Roger Federer on center, guaranteed centre court match with all that he'd done on the tour, and choked and was kind of choked, to be honest, in my last round of qualifying at Wimbledon as well. But I got over the line. I was 2 sets to love up and 5-1, and I think I was 5-4 by the time I actually won that. I was incredibly nervous. It was actually a different type of a nerves than I felt in the first round. In the match against Manarino, I started to get too aggressive too quickly in the rally and made a lot of mistakes, but I actually never felt a huge amount of physical nerves in the way I did against in the last round of qualifying. But I think that my age definitely played into that. I think the fact that I was experiencing this for the first time at 29 and knew I was going to have slim, more opportunities for this type of situation. You know, if I was 21 or 22, you know, my first round win at Wimbledon, I was probably going to go and do this for another 10 or 15 years playing this tournament. Whereas I knew deeply that this was maybe my one chance to get on centre court at Wimbledon. So it was a heavier kind of pressure again, even than somebody who's maybe a little bit younger.
Because reading through it as well, and you go through many of the games that you played at various times in your career, and I was struck by at times that you seemed regretful that maybe you were a little bit too passive at times. And then also, and this maybe sounds a bit contradictory, but that at times you were impatient.
Yeah, and that was the thing with the Manarino finish. Was I'd been working for the previous couple of years on being aggressive, and that was what I felt like had gotten me to the next level, where I was starting to play Grand Slam main draws. And I always had a natural predisposition to be a little bit passive, especially when I got ahead. It's like a soccer team that's defending a lead and they just all camp back. I had a tendency to do the equivalent of that in tennis. So then when I got to the 4-1 against Manarino, I said, I got to stay aggressive. I got to stay on the front foot here. And obviously I overcooked it and the match got away from me very quickly. And I think when you get nervous, you're not comfortable. And obviously if you're not comfortable, you start to make rash decisions and you start going for the bigger shot too early in the rally. So I was going for the big winner down the line in the third shot of the point, whereas the whole match previous I'd been doing it later in the rally and being a lot more patient and building the points, which I, you know, that chapter, The Longest Day, where I take you through that chapter, that whole match against Manarino, build the point is a constant reminder that I have and a cue in my brain for doing the right thing, but it obviously got away from me at the end.
I know you got assistance from Gavin Cooney in sort of editing the book and the rest of it. I believe you sat down with him and watched some of the games, did you?
That's right. Yeah, so I have a degree in English from Berkeley. I wrote a lot of this. A lot of the prose is mine. Gavin was also very involved and we dovetailed on this a lot, and he was brilliant to work with. And yeah, we sat down and I dusted off the old DVD of the Manarino match. It had been sent to me a couple of weeks after I lost, and I couldn't bear to look at it, to be honest. And then we took an afternoon and sat down and watched the 4 hours, give or take. We fast forwarded, a few bits. And it was really interesting to watch it back. You know, it was interesting. I couldn't barely remember whether I'd won the second set or the third set or the fourth set. You know, I couldn't even remember I knew it was obviously best of five. I knew it was 6-4 in the fifth. I knew there'd been a tie break in between, but I couldn't necessarily tell you. So going through that was really interesting. And yeah, we were able to take you through not a shot by shot account, but that chapter is really, really detailed, and I think is quite unique in terms of you're getting inside the head of somebody who's playing a match at Wimbledon, and I think it works really well, that chapter.
Hello and welcome to our latest edition of Magnified. We're back with the interview series where we get the chance to talk in detail with our guests, and we're joined today by Jenny Kelly and Mairead Rowland. I'll tell you why in a moment we're talking to them, but just to let you know that this series of Magnified is brought to you by Close Brothers Motor Finance, which is recognised on Trustpilot as best in class for motor finance, customer service, speed of decisions and support in Ireland. Motor dealerships and brokers looking to join the network should get in touch and speak to the team at closemotorfinance.ie. So let's get to our guests today, Mairead Rowland, Jenny Kelly. Other things I want to pick up on from the book, I'm sure maybe a personal prejudice here, but I am fascinated in how you have spoken about giving up alcohol.
Mm.
Because I had a very interesting experience when I didn't entirely give up, right? So I occasionally still have a glass of wine or whatever if I'm having a good meal out, or like a nice glass of red wine, but it might be one at the max two. But when I first stopped drinking, which would be nearly 20 years ago now, the amount of grief I got from people about it, and you put your finger on it in one of the interviews as well, is that people start telling you, you'll be no crack if you're not drinking.
Yeah. Mm. That was one of the biggest things. So I stopped in the summer of 2018. Okay. And I didn't tell anybody for months because I just knew I could not cope with people's reaction to it. And my biggest fear at the time was somebody saying to me, which sounds so bizarre, what'll you have to drink? And I'd be like, oh my God, what am I going to say? As opposed to going, I'll just have a sparkling water or whatever. I just thought, I'm not ready for this conversation. But when I first went out and decided this is the time, I'm going to be strong here after 6 months and I'm going to be able to go, mine's a sparkling water. It was a Christmas girls' lunch, which was probably the most stupid thing to do, which is like the annual thing. And it's a lunch that goes on for many hours, and it always was great fun. And I remember I sat down and the waiter came over and he was like, champagne, sparkling wine, you know, for everybody, Prosecco. And I was like, no, thank you, I'll just have sparkling water. And the heads literally, whoom. And everyone was like, what do you mean? What, you're not going to have fun? You're not going to have fun with us today. And the questions came and they kept coming. And I kept saying,
what sort of questions? I'm just interested. So I know what sort of questions I was asked.
So I was like, for this particular lunch, what I found interesting that day was I tried to dismiss it because I didn't want to make it about me not drinking. I was like, I'm just not drinking. Everybody just fire ahead and do your own thing. But I noticed then that everyone started talking about their drinking. As in, well, I can take it or leave it. And then somebody else was like, oh, I'm only going to have a few drinks tonight. And oh, no, well, I was out last night, so I'm going to probably have a few. And then I've actually thought about stopping drinking as well. And it became like a big discussion that went on for about an hour.
Did nobody think of asking you whether you were sick or something, that you actually had to stop drinking for a medical reason or anything like that?
No, nobody.
That's interesting about your friends, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did anybody ask you? And I had this experience from a few people who were practically strangers who asked me when they realised I wasn't drinking at events, they asked me, was I an alcoholic?
Mm.
Did anyone ask you that?
Well, people have kind of done the head tilt and the,
you don't drink anymore.
Because there is this assumption, and I probably was the same, that you're sold this idea that you are either a normal drinker or an alcoholic. But there's no grey area there. And I think that keeps a lot of people, it stops them from stopping drinking because they go, well, I'm not an alcoholic, so I'll just try to manage my drinking. Mm. And I've heard so much of that, like those discussions, oh, I'm only going to have three drinks tonight. Or when I go out, and I'm going to have water between each drink. And you're kind of trying to tell yourself, you're giving yourself a reason as to why you can drink, as opposed to just going out and saying, well, maybe I won't drink tonight, because you're terrified of not drinking, because we've all been conditioned to think going out, having fun equals drinking.
Well, it equals getting drunk as opposed to just drinking.
Yeah.
I think in the Irish psyche, it's very much about going out and getting pissed.
Margaret, admit, listen, just ignore Jenny for a second though, okay? Just pretend she's not
okay.
Here. Is Jenny any crack anymore since she stopped drinking on a night out, Mairead?
If I can be really honest, I think Jenny's more crack now.
I didn't pay her.
Shouldn't pay
that
him to say
is,
that.
That's outrageous ass kissing.
I think you are.
Well, like I described in the book that how I felt when I went out was like Jim Carrey and the mask. Mm. That like I'd go out and I'd stick the mask on and my personality would rev up about 200%. And which my personality does not need to be revved up.
Nobody needed 200% more, Jenny.
And if I and I did, I've spent like a good few years. Like it's been one of the probably the biggest changes in my entire life to get serious. Like it really is a huge thing for me and in Ireland to stop drinking. And I feel when I was drinking all those years that I probably was careless about things that I said. I was probably, probably careless around people and not mindful of people and thoughtless. And I'm really glad that that side of me has been put away, because I don't really like that version of myself.
Mm.
So...
is this inspiring you to give up drink, Mairead? Not that you need to give up drink or anything like that. But.
No, I mean, I kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm going to sound like one of the lunch friends now, Jenny, but I enjoy every drink I have. I don't drink a lot, but every drink I have, I really enjoy. And I suppose because of what Jenny has done, I'm a lot braver now when it comes to nights where I do not want to drink, because I might have a run of busyness ahead of me, and I can go out and I can be with friends and I can easily say now, no, I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm busy for the next few days, and the night continues on as normal. But I wouldn't have done that before.
Of course, when you became friends, you would have partied a lot.
Oh God. Oh, God, oh yeah. My God, we partied very hard.
We partied very hard.
You were unusual, and I say this from having worked in Today FM from 2003, January 2003, and I would have worked with you, Mairead, prior to that.
When 2002, you were on,
when you came into the station, and I was on many occasions that year sitting in for Eamon Dunphy, who was out writing his Roy Keane book. So I would have been around quite a bit, so I would have known you from back there. But whereas teams often do socialise together, I doubt if there's ever been a team in radio that socialised together as much as the Ray Darcy team.
Yeah, we did.
And went on holidays.
Went on holidays and went on bank holiday weekends away together. I mean, when you look
slept in camper vans together.
Yeah. We used to...
What was all that about?
I don't know. What was it about? We were just... It was very incestuous, really.
And do you know other friends?
We did.
We had other friends. We probably didn't get to see them a lot.
No, we didn't.
I think it was just a moment in time that we all loved what we were doing.
Yeah.
We worked insane hours, but we didn't even clock those up as
no,
hours.
No, they never felt
it
like
it wasn't
work.
Like, oh my God, I'm still working, it's 8 o'clock. It was like, it was, we were all so kind of determined and to make the show
really successful.
Really successful and as good as it could be. And there was the sense that we were kind of growing up with the listeners and we were having so much fun and we were getting feedback from them, and we just kind of didn't want that to end. When the show ended, we didn't want to kind of go home. We wanted to hang out with each other.
If we look back to any of the many things we did on the show, if you clocked up the hours, I mean, it's totally illegal, like the amount of hours we worked. I mean, one, we talked about this a while ago, it was a thing we did to try and find Ireland's next comedian, right? And we set out on a Sunday. On a Sunday, we drove to Cork. We stayed overnight in a hotel. We would have worked that night.
Hang on, I was going to say, that night we would have set up.
We would have set up, And then the next morning did the show for 3 hours. Then after that, I can't remember, we would have been preparing the show the next day. Then we had to be ready to have a show on a bus with a live audience of 50 people at 5:30. Then we would have taken that audio. We would have edited that audio for packages for the next day. Finished editing, I don't know, 11, half 11 at night. Probably had a bottle of red wine at the same time. And the next morning it continued, and that was only Tuesday. And then we also had to finish that show on Tuesday and then drive to Galway to do the whole thing again.
Set up again.
And we did that. Now, at no point would we have asked for day off overtime. Work or overtime or yeah. it just didn't happen.
It didn't even come into our heads.
So
though.
that was the norm for how things happened at that time on the Ray Darcy show. I mean, you just wouldn't get away with it now.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it. You weren't required to work that hard when you got to RTÉ, Ray, over, did you?
What? Well, what podcast? Can we just stop recording for a second?
Ed, keep that in. We need to take a break.
Absolutely staying in. That's the central point of the entire podcast.
We need to take a break. Back with more Magnified, Moraine Ronan and Jenny Kelly after this. Welcome back to Magnified, Moraine Ronan and Jenny Kelly with us today. So, if you were picking one part out of the book that you want to talk about, what would be the one that you think we should talk about?
Oh my God.
I don't know.
Well, like, we've already touched on the alcohol one, which is probably the one that I am like incredibly proud of. Mm. Like, I loved writing that, and I've probably had kind of the most interesting reaction. Like, even when we did our live podcast, a couple of women came up, and emails we've had in since from people who have read the book. It's allowing kind of what I was saying at the beginning about starting conversations. It's allowing those conversations start, as in somebody else is seeing that somebody else did it. And so that I am very proud of. I kind of really like the joy one and being human.
Yeah, being human.
Yeah. I love all that. And I like also when we talked about our kind of different take on aging.
Yeah.
Well, talk to me about aging. Because, as I said, I've known you for over 20 years.
Yeah, and I haven't aged today.
Not at all. But you were a child when you were in here, Maria.
I was a child. I mean, I came in here as a 21-year-old. I hadn't finished college yet. And then turned 22 very quickly and never left. So, I mean, that can keep you immature in one way, but I came in here as a very old head on young shoulders, didn't I? Didn't I really?
But it was kind of surface level old.
Surface level old, yeah. I feel like I'm only really mature now in the last few years.
I mean, down to the fact that it wasn't long after your mother had died as well.
It is true, because my mom had died just a year before. Yeah. I, at the time, felt like the most mature person in my family, and include my dad in that. Like, my dad and my two much older sisters. There's 9 years. One is 9 years older, one is 12 years older.
One 9 years older, similar age gap to Jenny.
Yeah. Mm. You're only 8 years older, so don't put her as old as Olga. She's not as old as Olga.
Yeah, add 9 years.
But,
similar.
Yeah. They fell apart, really. I mean, physically and mentally fell apart when my mom died, and I felt like I had it all together. So I was very mature, very solid, and I felt like, you know, I've got things sussed out. I don't know if that served me very well in my 20s, though. You know, because I went down a road of, I got married very young, very, very young. I got engaged at 23. I was extremely young. Got married at 24. Much to Jenny screaming at me. Jenny, like, are you sure? You're very young.
That's because my mother had always said, never even contemplate getting married before the age of 30. Mm-hmm. I had that drummed into me. So I remember looking at Mairead and just thinking, God, she's so young.
But actually, see, this actually brings us something else, in that you were unusual to become best friends, given that 8 year gap in your 20s. Mm. I mean, an 8 year gap at the age you're at now, if you'd met later
is
on,
nothing.
Is nothing.
No, that doesn't exist.
But when you're in your 20s, like, it's sort of like 21-year-old gravitates to 29-year-old and you take 21-year-old under your wing.
But we'd say that's because Jenny would admit herself that she was very immature, and I was behaving like this 29-year-old, 30-year-old, you know. So we just met in the middle. We were the same.
Yeah, and again, going back to our working life, because we were literally together the whole time. Mm. And our personalities just clicked. Mm.
So. Which is weird, because on paper we wouldn't.
Don't do that old gag.
I'm telling you what. But we wouldn't be friends. It's like, you know, you're Poshy from Fox Rock.
I'm from
working class Finglas. I mean, it's just, you know.
You're now indistinguishable.
Do you think?
Yeah.
No,
you
she's
sound
just.
It's sound the way. A bit alike.
Oh, do we?
No, you're still Ray. Ray.
I think this is disgraceful. But anyway, Mairead, you were talking about aging.
Aging. Oh God, what else are we talking? Well, I suppose we have different approaches to aging, don't we? I, you know, Jenny's trying to get me to like let my hair grow out and be grey because I'm very, very grey. Not a chance that's happening. It will not happen.
Don't do it.
It will never happen.
Don't do it.
It's never going to, Matt, you don't have to worry about it. It's never going to happen. Yeah. Jenny's like, I think you look really cool.
In my defense, I don't think I ever actually said that because like, I've seen you through every hair color.
Yeah.
I think I have.
No, you
every
have.
Single
every
hair,
single hair color.
Hair color. But I think when it comes to aging, it was more, I am suspicious of a whole industry that is based on female insecurity. You know, we're kind of sold this idea that, you know, it's self-care and you're just doing it for yourself. And I go, really? Are we?
Yeah.
Or are we not told that aging, it's not acceptable to age, that it's not acceptable as a woman to have lines in your face or to, I'm not even talking about the hair.
So you don't Botox?
Well, I think you can tell I don't.
No, I'm asking. Yeah. I'm not making any assumptions.
Yeah, no, I don't.
But the assumption I was making based on the way you were speaking rather than looking
Yeah,
at you.
No.
I think you'd love Profilo. Ah! I think you'd love Profilo.
What's that?
Profilo is, it is injected into your face and it is like intense moisturizer, basically. That's a very, very kind of basic
way. It's not Botox, though.
It's not, no. So you have movement, but you've got this really gorgeous glow on your face. Now, it does hurt.
Do you do that?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I do Profilo, yeah. Yeah, okay. And I love it. Now, it hurts.
Is it like Botox as well?
It's injected.
You have to do it for the rest of your
life? Yeah, it is. I mean, like when it's gone, I look wrecked.
She doesn't.
How often do you have to
do it? She doesn't.
Probably every 6 to 9 months. So it could be twice a year or you could stretch it out a little bit more. Whereas Botox, I think you have to get that done like every 3 months, you know, 3 to 4 months. But Profilo is, it's lovely. I like it. I'm a fan of it.
And if you like it and it makes you happy.
Yeah. And like, I suppose that's where we differ. Jenny would think, you know, I'm a bit mad doing that, but I do like it.
No, it's not a judgment call. We all do whatever the hell we want to do. But I suppose I'm looking as well. I have a near 18-year-old daughter and I get sad thinking about the world that she's in and it's much worse for her than it ever was for me. And they're constantly looking at their faces and they're constantly picking out their phones in their hands, their imperfections. And they're being told, and it annoys me, they're being told that there's a way that they can fix themselves. They can make themselves be better by looking better. And I just think that's so insipid and it's sad. It's very, very sad, I think, that young people are kind of going out into the world thinking about all the ways that they can fix themselves to have this outward so-called perfect look.
It's just the way things have moved on. I don't agree with it either, but you know, Back in our generation, a girl who had like tiny boobs wore a big push-up bra with padding in it.
It's not the same.
Hair extensions. You get braces to fix your imperfect teeth.
No, it's not the same.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mairead. Is it that just every generation
has a new thing?
It's expressed in different ways.
I do. I think that. I don't agree with this. And I'm saying there's like sucky in corsets now, which are back. They were there a long, long time ago. Now they're all back to give women a smaller waist. That's
and
all
they
the
were
Kardashian
sort of
thing.
Jettisoned on the basis that they were actually anti-feminist. Yeah. They were sort of oppressive of women.
Yeah.
And they go, no, suddenly they're brought back as a symbol of freedom.
All the Kardashians kind of wearing those. I don't agree with it, but I just feel like it moves on and the whole cosmetic world moves on. I mean, you have things from basic makeup to contour your face to make you look like you've cheekbones when you don't have them, with contouring to injecting and fixing things that probably don't need to be fixed.
I think it's not just injecting and fixing because those things wear off. I think people going off and putting themselves in severe danger to have full-on surgery, all like, I just don't get it. I've never got it.
Yeah.
I feel sad.
That is definitely a step too far. Mm. For me too, but I do think that that's the way it's going to be because we go. I think it's like dentistry is nobody questions that now. Nobody does. You know, people just.
Well,
go,
I do.
I'm
permanently looking at people who are going around with those Simon Cowell teeth, going, "That is terrible." So they are. There are people out there who are questioning. There, most people now watch TV and go, oh my God, look what she's done to her lips. Oh my God, look at the Botox. Oh my God, look at the white teeth. So they are questioning it.
Yeah. Well, we do say a lot of the times, leave your lips alone. Leave your lips, leave your lips alone.
You know, you said earlier in this podcast about your own podcast, which you think is almost exclusively listened to by women.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope the men who listen to this podcast are still listening. They haven't got a listening to these women earlier
on.
Yeah,
they might be
gone.
But
an insight into the female brain.
But see, that's what I was just about to bring up, because I wonder if those who are still listening to us, you know, what they're getting from this conversation and what do you think would they get from the book? I mean, if men were to secretly sit down over Christmas, maybe they buy the book for their wife or for their girlfriend. But if they were to pick it up and just have a look at it, what do you think would they get out of it?
That's a good question.
What would they get out of it? I'd probably get some tips into.
Can I turn that question
back
on you?
No, you can't.
Can I turn that to you against one?
But as a man,
what did you feel that you learned? Or maybe you didn't, but is there something that you learned?
No, I mean, I did find it very interesting in parts. I'm just sort of like, yes, I mean, I suppose I am at the moment living with wife and three adult women, as well as two other boys. So I've had to learn an awful lot over the last 25 years or so about what it is about girls and about women growing up, given that I was an only child. So I never grew up with sisters or anything like that, and understanding that. So I suppose I'm on my own ever evolving journey and trying to understand. So I related to an awful lot of what you had in the book, which, shall I say, wasn't necessarily unfamiliar to me.
Okay.
But I wonder then, does every man necessarily, and I'm not trying to hold myself up virtuously here, take that sort of interest in what it is that women are interested in?
But I think there's loads in the book. I know we've said, like, the majority of our listeners are women, and the book is obviously very pink, and, you know, we would think that men possibly will go into bookshops and go, oh, that would be a great Christmas present and give, you know, people giving to their sisters and best friends. But there's a lot within the book as well that is our own kind of general philosophy, which, you know, which I think is like anybody could read that and get something from it. So, you know, we even talk about kind of Stoic philosophy in there, our favorite quote, you know, you'll be dead forever. You know, that whole idea of memento mori and, you know, remember you will die.
And things keep that are equally applicable to men as to women.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And to keep that ever present, and talking of present, we're constantly talking about that, to live in the present moment as much as we can, that we all tend to catastrophize either by looking to the past.
Which you can do nothing about.
Or looking at the future, you can, again, do nothing about that. All we can all do, hopefully, is try to live as much as we can in the present moment. So I think that's a lesson for everyone, not just women.
Yeah. Well, there's other things in there that I talk about IVF. I mean, that affects men greatly too. And raising teens, you know, men could get a female perspective on that, because sometimes, you know, dads and teenagers can clash a lot.
As mothers and teens.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. As mothers and teens can too. Exactly. What else is in there? Oh my God, I'm trying to think.
Well, how much of that comes down to then, though, also working in partnership with the other parent?
Oh, that's so important. And actually, on this week's podcast, we talk about that. I talk about how it's so important to be, you know, on the one team. You mean, that's really what a good marriage or a good partnership is, in my eyes. It's just you're playing on the same team. And yes, you can have differences in opinions when it comes to different things, but when you're raising the kids, you really have to be aligned on everything, and you have to back each other up on everything. I think that's so important, especially when they're teens.
Given that you both have teens turning into adulthood,
yeah,
what would they make of the book, do you reckon?
Well,
I wouldn't expect him to be reading it now.
No.
Yeah, well, actually, Dara has.
Has he?
Yeah, Dara has read it. And I gave Dara certain chapters to look at before I sent them to the editor. So what myself and Jenny did, I would write a piece or she would write a piece, and we'd send it to each other. And we'd give each other feedback before we would send it over to Gil, our publishers.
I think we were kind of minding each other.
Yeah, we were. We were minding
like,
each other.
I'd be like, maybe you want to reconsider this
last
bit
part.
There,
yeah, or maybe you want to change that, or maybe you want to add in a little bit more there. Or, so I let Dara see a couple of chapters. One that is pretty much about him raising teens, and he laughed at it. So he was very happy with that. I didn't have to make any changes. One about divorce, because obviously it involves his dad and very much him as well, you know.
Yep.
And then one about IVF, because I just, you know, it's our family. Mm. So he read those three chapters before they went to Gil, and he was happy with all of them. And but then he's read the full book then, and he really likes it. Yeah, he's
good. And you know what would be fascinating would be if he read it again in 10 years time, in 20 years time, and what he actually thinks then.
But then, yeah. I mean, it's a lovely thing for our kids to have, which I'm sure it's lovely for your children to have, you know, books, other books you've written too. It's lovely.
I know, a couple of them might have read one or two of them, but yes, but I wouldn't expect them to.
It's a lovely thing.
Well, Kate has not read.
Has she not?
No. And she wouldn't. I think it would just make her feel uncomfortable. I think she'll probably in a couple of years.
She'll get to it later on.
Yeah. And that's fine. Mm. I'm like, that's absolutely fine. That's fine.
That's
Kate.
Fine. Fine.
Well, can I ask you, I mean, how do you feel about revealing so much of yourselves?
It really didn't feel like that. And I would have felt like that if I was still on radio every day. So it's strange taking the step back and then doing the podcast almost 2 years. With the podcast listeners, it feels very intimate, doesn't it? It feels like we know them, that they're pals. So it didn't feel like I was, you know, revealing much more of myself than I already have. Although I did. We both did.
Yeah, we did speak about stuff that we have never spoken about
before. Yeah, but I almost felt strangely safe doing it because maybe a very naive, I thought the only people who'll buy this are listeners to our podcast. So it doesn't matter about it being out there. And I've since learned that it is very much out there. And we do interviews like this. And we did like the cover of the Irish Independent Weekend magazine. And you're going, oh shit, actually other people
Isn't
are going
to it interesting
to read
though? Because I always think that's why I love radio so much and podcasts, because you're in your studio world and it's so intimate.
Yeah.
I always find it very bizarre when somebody who I kind of wouldn't think of as a listener will say something back to me like, oh, I heard you say that. I get really quite nervous around that. It's almost like they've listened into a private conversation. So,
which you put out there.
Which you publish it. And I kind of feel that with the book, kind of what you were saying, like a couple of years ago, definitely wouldn't have been able to write it.
Yeah.
And like definitely for me, there's absolutely no way I would have allowed myself be vulnerable and put it pen to paper, you know, tap it out in a book. I just wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have felt able. I wouldn't have felt safe. I kind of have this idea of being kind of... Are you okay?
Yeah. Sorry, just pinging my iPad, which I didn't
expect. No, it's fine.
Sorry.
I was kind of raised and praised for being independent and, you know, self-reliant, and I wouldn't have allowed kind of vulnerability come into my world because I kind of would have thought it was a bit of a weakness. Whereas now, and we've spoken about this, I kind of see it as superpower. It's not to say that I'm walking around being Mrs. Vulnerable the whole time, because it's not completely in my nature, but I have found the more I open up, and like it's a really lovely experience because you get so much back when you open up.
Yeah.
Isn't it great to be in that place?
It is.
It's lovely.
I think that is also part of aging. You know, you give less of a fuck. And
you can say it, Marie.
Yeah, okay. You give less of a fuck. Yeah. And
it's your fuck it era.
It's your fuck it era. And my fuck it era.
Apple to have a change in our terms and conditions for the rating of this podcast.
But, and I think you realize as well, as an aging woman, middle aged, you realize that we're all the same. We've all experienced the same stuff. We all kind of feel the same way. And by us sharing our stories, like Jenny has said, we get so much back from our listeners too.
This has been a different Magnified, but I've really enjoyed your company. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
and
Matt.
Congratulations on the book, What We Know Now, Lessons in Life, Love, Loss and Friendship. And remind me the name of the podcast again is?
It's Jenny and Raid Now. Because it was us then on Today FM. This is us now.
And we also love saying, now,
now, now, that's now. That done. Now, 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 who now. Wants tea?
Now, who wants a spray mop?
Now, that's now. The dog walked.
Now, Matt.
Now, put that wash on.
Now.
Enough, enough. Thank you. So thanks again to Jenny and Mairead for being with us. And of course, also thank you to our series partner, Close Brothers Motor Finance, your best in class motor finance customer service based on trust and technology with the portal Close Connect is designed to make life easier for dealers, partners and brokers. So motor dealerships and brokers looking to join the network should get in touch with and speak to the team at closemotorfinance.ie. So that's it for this edition of Magnified. We have lots of other great guests for you to meet on this series, so do please join us.
Magnified with Matt Cooper, proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. With Close Connect, our technology means we can say yes more often, approve finance applications in minutes and sometimes seconds. Partner with Close Brothers Motor Finance at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.